Paris, APC. And well, before I start, I wanted to thank again the Perimeter Institute and thank Louis Lehner for inviting me, because it's a great pleasure to be here and to present to you some recent works that I've been doing with my advisor, Nathalie Doriel, regarding the extension of the EOB, so effective one body framework, to modified gravities. So as everybody knows, we live now in a new era in gravitational wave astronomy that was opened by the first detection of binary black hole coalescence, and more recently the coalescence of two neutron stars. And with that comes the opportunity to bring new tests of modified gravities, specifically in the strong field regime of the merger of two compact objects. Now, in the case of GR, there is a framework that has been developed now for 20 years, in fact, which is called EOB, Effective One Body, which has proven to be a very powerful tool to describe analytically the motion of two compact bodies up to the merger. And the basic idea of this EOB framework is to reduce your two-body problem that you know at some post-Newtonian order, say. You map it to the geodesic motion of a test particle in some effective EOB metric that you have to determine. So this framework today is used a lot to build libraries of templates for the LIGO collaboration. So knowing that it works so well for GR, we wondered with Nathalie Doriel, my advisor, if this approach, you could extend it or not to modified gravities. So we took the simplest example among them, which is massless scalar tensor theories. So the goal of the first part of this seminar will be twofold. First, I will show you how in practice you perform this EOB dictionary. And second, I will show you, well, what are the scalar tensor corrections that appear on top of GR. Okay, and also I will concentrate only on the first building block of EOB, which is concentrating on the conservative part of motion. Okay, so by massless scalar tensor theories, I mean theories that can be written in the Einstein frame as GR plus a massless scalar field, but where matter fields, psi, they non-minimally couple to the Einstein frame. In fact, they minimally couple to the Jordan metric. So, which is defined through this conformal function here, A of phi, that defines your theory. Now, if you are interested in the motion of two compact bodies, what you can do is replace them by point-point particles. But now, naively, you would say, since matter is minimally coupled to the Jordan metric, I will decide that these points follow the geodesics of the Jordan metric. Well, in fact, it was understood by Hurdley in the 70s that this is not what you should do. In fact, this mass should become a function of the local value of the scalar field evaluated at the location of the point. And a way to understand this by shaking hands is the following. If you consider a compact body here, in GR, the only influence of a faraway companion is to perturb the background metric here. But that you can erase by going to the locally inertial frame. So it has no impact on the equilibrium of the body here. Now, in scalar tensor theories, you also have a scalar field that you cannot erase anymore. And so this can have an impact on the equilibrium configuration of the body here. And hence, this M of phi function can even depend on the internal structure of the body, for example, depend on its equation of state. So this breaks now the strong equivalence principle, because the trajectories of strongly self-gravitating bodies is not universal anymore. Okay, so if you go back to the Einstein frame, using again this relation between the Jordan and Einstein metric, you can define the Einstein frame mass, which takes into account at the same time self-gravity effects and the non-minimal coupling to the conformal function A. So the difference between the two-body problem in GR and scalar tensor theories is that instead of having only two mass constants, you have now two mass functions. And hence, the problem becomes much more complicated. So our starting point will be what is known today about the two-body problem in scalar tensor theories, which is the Lagrangian that was computed by Mirshikari and Will at second post-Keplerian order, which means corrections of order v over c to the 4, so weak, small velocities and weak field. So in particular, you expand in this framework your metric around a flat background, Minkowski metric, and a constant scalar field background that is imposed by cosmology, say, that we will call phi zero. So in particular, your two mass functions now at second post-Keplerian order, you don't need to know them exactly. You simply expand them around this cosmological background phi zero. So at this order, we will need basically 8 fundamental mass parameters. So you simply expand log of m, so m zero, first derivative, second, etc. Note in particular, this parameter will be the most important. It will be the leitmotif of this seminar. Alpha is sometimes called the scalar charge because it measures the basic coupling between your body and the scalar field. Okay. So here is what you have. At Keplerian order, you recognize a Newton's-like Lagrangian, but where Newton's constant, G, has been replaced by an effective gravitational coupling, GAAB, that is 1 plus alpha squared, so 1 plus scalar charge squared, which reflects the linear addition of the metric and scalar field interactions. At first post-Keplerian order, you have two new contractions of the 8 fundamental mass parameters that appear, that in particular are driven by alpha squared. Note this, it will be important later in this seminar. At second post-Keplerian order, the Lagrangian gets bigger and bigger, and again you have some other contractions of the 8 mass parameters, so delta, epsilon, theta, that again are driven at least by alpha squared. Okay, so this is our starting point. So what you can do first is eliminate the accelerations here by means of what is called a contact transformation. It's basically a four-dimensional coordinate change that allows you to find a whole class of coordinate systems in which your Lagrangian does not depend on the accelerations anymore. Once you've done this, it is very easy to compute the associated ordinary Hamiltonian. So there it is. This is the basic structure that you find. So I did not copy all of the HI coefficients here. They just depend on the coordinate system in which you are working and on the 8 fundamental mass parameters. Okay, so we have this huge Hamiltonian that contains all the post-Keplerian, second post-Keplerian information that you know about the two-body problem in scalar tensor theories. And it depends on 17 coefficients. So now let us turn to another problem, which is much simpler and that everybody knows, which is the geodesic motion of a point particle in some effective metric here, so a static spherically symmetric metric. So in those coordinates, it depends only on two functions, g0, 0, and grr, that I will call a and b. And again, this dynamics, you can describe it equivalently by a Hamiltonian that, again, you can restrict to its second post-Keplerian approximation by simply expanding g0, 0, and grr in a 1 over r series. So at 2pk order, you only have 5 coefficients. So on the one hand, we have a huge two-body Hamiltonian that depends on 17 coefficients. On the other hand, we have a much simpler Hamiltonian that depends only on 5. The whole point of EOB, the main idea, is to say, I will build a map between the two. So a dictionary. And that you can do by means of two main ingredients. The first ingredient is a canonical transformation that at second post-Keplerian order depends on 9 parameters, the alpha, beta, etc. So this is the most generic generating function that you can write. Basically, it does not depend on the angle phi because you want to preserve isotropy, and it does not depend on time because we are considering two conservative problems. The second ingredient, which is at the heart of EOB, is to impose a functional relation between your effective geodesic Hamiltonian and your two-body Hamiltonian. And this relation, which is called the EOB functional relation, is quadratic. So on the left-hand side, you have the effective one, and on the right-hand side, the two-body Hamiltonian here, where nu here is the symmetric mass ratio. It's 0 in the test mass limit and 1/4 in the equal mass case. So 0 because you know that in the test mass limit, your two-body problem has to reduce to the geodesic motion in a Schwarzschild metric. Okay, so now, a priori, that kind of EOB mapping, it is not guaranteed that you will find a solution. The reason is that we are trying to connect the left-hand side of this equation that depends on 5 parameters to the right-hand side that depends on 17 coefficients. And that's by means of a canonical transformation that depends on 9 parameters. So in fact, that makes 3 constraints to be satisfied by the coefficients of your two-body Hamiltonian. So this simply tells you that not any two-body problem of any modified gravities can be mapped towards a geodesic motion.
So Felix, yeah. So if you do this, so if you're talking about a modified gravity, so in particular, you could imagine thinking of it just general relativity. So how many parameters would you have in that case?
In a generic theory? 17. At this order, it is 17, yes.
But if it's not an extension, an alternative to GR, but it is GR, the one you start with, you still have 17 parameters?
Yes. So yes. So what I wrote here is the most generic two-body Lagrangian that you could have, and then of course you have explicit expressions for GR scalar tensor series. But what I'm saying here is completely generic.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is really a generic case.
Yeah. So the question I always have here is: suppose I have this, the problem I have in mind, my two bodies that are interacting is one where I have a comparable mass or not. I don't care, but I have one of them, let's say the larger mass object has nearly maximal spin. Let's say, because I can imagine that situation.
Maximal spin?
Nearly maximal spin. So,
yes.
So now I'm going to try to match it on the left-hand side to a Schwarzschild.
Yes. So
there has to be some price to pay.
Yeah. So what I'm saying, so here I'm looking at the case where you have no spin. If you have a spin, what is done, in fact, you need more degrees of freedom in your effective Hamiltonian, and what people do is, you feel like what you have to do is map towards a geodesic motion in a deformed Kerr metric. So this is what you look for. So then you also have an effective spin that appears. And so, okay. So here, no spins, second post-Keplerian order, and we are generic.
The vacuums to black hole solutions for Jordan's friends take you not good.
So you said we have black hole?
Because they.
In a scalar tensor series? Yes, so.
First published by Brands in 1962.
So here.
Just Schwarzschild, because they. Not Schwarzschild, they find it in non energy continuum. Mm-hmm. So you have singular curvature invariance.
Yes. This is what.
So on.
Usually, yes, you say that in scalar tensor theories, the black holes have no hair, and you are back to GR.
So
in that case, yes, we will concentrate on neutron stars, but in the second half of this seminar, I will concentrate on Einstein Maxwell Dilayton theories that are, an explicit example of, modified gravities that you know. Where you have hairy black holes. So I will also discuss this case.
It's interesting because the merger of the black holes, where you expect to see deviations from GR.
Yes.
Scalar tensor is not good. These are isolated black holes.
Yes, exactly. So I will also discuss this aspect. So we have explicit solutions for isolated black holes, and what you do, even in GR, you neglect the finite size effects, so you suppose that the two companions are far away. But if you have tidal forces and all that, I will mention this too, so it becomes a bit more complicated. So here, no finite size effects, etc. So where was I? Yeah, so the three constraints on your two-body Hamiltonian. The first one, at first post-Keplerian order, is this one. But in fact, for any theories whose purely kinematical terms come from the Lorentz invariance square root of 1 minus v squared, as is the case for GR and scalar tensor theories, these coefficients are always zero. So this is not, this is restrictive only for Lorentz breaking theories. At second post-Keplerian order, you have another constraint which is not more restrictive for exactly the same reasons. Now the third constraint is restrictive. So a priori, not any Lorentz invariant Hamiltonian satisfies this constraint. Now what happens is that in GR, of course, it is satisfied if you replace all of these HIs by the HIs of GR, but it is also satisfied by scalar tensor theories. So that means you are allowed to reduce the two-body problem in scalar tensor theories to the geodesic motion in a simple metric. Okay, so this is what I will show to you. Here is the metric that you find, the EOB metric that you find. So again, A is G0 and B is GRR. So let me comment it by comparing it to the results of GR that was obtained by Buonanno and Damour, in fact, 20 years ago now. So the first thing that you can see is that at all orders, Newton's constant here, it has been replaced by the effective GAB. Remember, it was 1 plus alpha squared. But this first effect, you cannot distinguish from GR because it only amounts to rescaling your total mass, BM. So you can't see this. Now, at first post-Keplerian order, these two terms become interesting. These lead to deviations, observable deviations from GR. In fact, this metric is exactly the PPN-Eddington metric, but written in Drost coordinates. In fact, you can compute the betas and gammas of Eddington in terms of the parameter that entered the two-body Lagrangian. And they have very simple expressions. For example, the beta of Eddington is just a mean over the two bodies of the betas that entered the two-body Lagrangian. And the reason why it is so simple, the reason why this PPN metric appears is because, in fact, what we are doing here is in the spirit of PPN. We are trying to reduce the two-body problem of any modified gravity to a geodesic motion.
But you mentioned that in some cases you can do it, in other cases you cannot. So can you draw from it some general statement of what,
yeah, so
what could be accommodated in one way and what?
As I said, yes, you have to satisfy these constraints. So any theories, for example, if you forget about gravity, you take the two-body Lagrangian of electrodynamics, at second post-Coulombian order, this isn't satisfied. So you cannot map the two-body problem of electrodynamics to a geodesic motion.
Right, so what if
for example,
that there is an algebraic,
yes,
set of constraints that one has to satisfy or not. But are you able to step out from the constraints? I
mean, you mean to
observations that
to guess
general principles might...
To guess, well, so I don't know if I can guess, but what I can say is if you want to map towards a geodesic motion, you know that, of course, it has to be Lorentz invariant, because geodesic motion is Lorentz invariant. Then at the other cases, I don't really know, but what I can say is, for example, for scalar tensor theories, in fact, although you have a metric and a scalar field, you know that the motion is a geodesic motion in the Jordan frame metric. So this is why you feel that you will manage to map it toward an effective metric. Yes?
G star m over r.
Yes. This?
So G star is bigger.
G star is?
G star is bigger than G nu.
Yes, it's the Newton constant, yes.
To agree with GR.
M has to be smaller, I don't
see. Yeah. The mass.
Yes.
If you put that, if G star is bigger than G Newton, because, you know, it has to agree with GR.
So G star is G Newton.
Yes.
G star is G Newton.
Yes, it's the. Yeah, this is G Newton. G A, A B is G Newton times 1 plus alpha A alpha B. This is your.
G A B can be bigger.
Yes, it can't be.
G A B is bigger than N is smaller in order to get the same value of G R.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So yes, this is what I said. So this you cannot distinguish from GR because all of this, so this is G star times 1 plus alpha squared.
Yeah.
So I could say, oh, well, what I measure is a total mass, which is the real total mass, the bare total mass, times 1 plus alpha squared. So this is why I said this first effect, you cannot distinguish C deviation from GR because you just you would miss the point. And big M is the total mass, right? It's the sum of the two masses.
This is the total.
Yes, it's the total mass. Yeah. So we are basically, it's just like Newton's reduction. You reduce the problem of motion of MA and MB as the reduced mass orbiting around the total mass.
So,
yes, this is the relativistic generalization. In fact, look, in the test mass limit in GR, when mu is zero, you recover the Schwarzschild metric, where you have the reduced mass mu orbiting around the total mass. And then EOB is here to compute the small corrections, so in mu. And what I add on top of this is also the small corrections coming from scalar tensor theories that are here and here. OK, and finally, at second post-Keplerian order, again, you have two new corrections that enter your metric that I just copied here. So now I think I should recall to you the size of the two-body Lagrangian at second post-Keplerian order. It took a whole slide to write it. Now, EOB helps us to boil it down to only two parameters. And again, I should recall to you that the geodesic motion in this metric is, by construction, canonically equivalent to the two-body Lagrangian from which we started. So there is a huge simplification. And the reason why is because we have hidden a lot of irrelevant information in the canonical transformation. Okay, but now we can do even better, because the point of EOB is also to define the resummation of the dynamics in order to estimate what might happen near merger. And the way you do it is the following. We had this functional relation between the geodesic and two-body Hamiltonian. Then if you invert it and you re-express your two-body Hamiltonian in terms of the effective one, you obtain the so-called EOB Hamiltonian, which is a square root of the geodesic Hamiltonian, which in turn is a square root containing G00 and GRR. Now here is the game that you play with EOB. You say, I will truncate the metric here. I will consider it just as if it was exact. Okay. And then I will not expand this square root anymore. When I do it, this defines a Hamiltonian that at least is well defined even in the strong field regime, while the two-body Lagrangian from which we started, by construction, it was wrong in the strong field regime. Now the whole hope of EOB is to say, if I write down the Hamilton's equations of this Hamiltonian, it will define a resummation of the two-body dynamics that maybe could capture the features of the strong field regime. And in fact, it works well, pretty well in the case of GR.
So, Felix, on that, yes, on the positron, the post-Keplerian order, I have a sense of orders at which point I could say, well, when would I stop trusting? So now, when you do the mapping to the EOB Hamiltonian, that is all gone.
So EOB is like a machine. You give it some information, you give it all you know, and from that, for example, from the post-Keplerian information, it gives you back a resummation. So here, all the post-Keplerian information enters at each order in the effective metric. So, of course, in principle, you should go to infinite post-Newtonian order to have something. But the more you add, the better your resummation will be, in a sense.
Right, what I was going to ask you, so the post-Keplerian world, I can ask, okay, how is this term, the next correction term, behaving and what its size is, and from there I can say, well, maybe I can trust it, the approximation up to here.
Yes.
What is the analog on the EOB side? I mean, is there something intrinsically to the EOB side where you could say, well, maybe I could trust it up to here, but I'm not sure it will be done?
I would say no. I would just say that the more you add, the better it is. But what is interesting with EOB is that, you know, in post-Newtonian expansions, sometimes it is badly convergent because you add a term and finally it goes away from what towards it was supposed to go. Well, with EOB, you don't have this anymore. You really have something that converges better. So you know that you might approach regularly the ultimate answer. Let's see. Okay. So how do you do in practice to compute your dynamics in the strong fit regime? Well, you simply write Hamilton's equations coming from this EOB Hamiltonian. But if you write them, you realize that because the geodesic Hamiltonian is conservative, it is a constant on shell. So in fact, your Hamilton's equations derived from the EOB Hamiltonian are exactly the same as the Hamilton's equations derived from the geodesic Hamiltonian to within a constant factor that is here. So that means that the motion is exactly the same as a geodesic motion, and what you have to do at the end is to rescale your time, and that's all you do. So there it is. We have completely reduced a complex two-body problem to a trivial standard textbook exercise. In fact, you just have to write the equations of motion in this effective metric, and that's all. So I will go a bit quick on that, because so you know that from the symmetries of the metric, you can define the conserved energy and angular momentum. Then you show that your radial motion is driven by an effective potential here. So you can define circular orbits, which correspond to the minimum of your potential. And you can even define an ISCO, which is a notion that comes from the geodesic motion. But this will correspond to typically in terms of your real problems to the radius where they will start plunging. So the ISCO is just the inflection point of the potential here. Okay. So now the last ingredient. Yes, by the way, since we are in Drost coordinates, in fact, the only part of the metric that appears is the G00 part. You don't need to know so much about B. So let's concentrate on G00 only. So this last ingredient, now we have it. It's the EOB metric that I just copied in a more compact form. So this is GR at 2 PM. This is epsilon is the Eddington beta minus gamma, remember? U is GAB M over R, okay? And this is the second post-Keplerian correction that I copied here. So now let us suppose that the scalar charge is small. That is that alpha squared is small. Remember what I said at the beginning, all of the contractions that appeared here, they were all driven by at least alpha squared. So what I will do in the following, in this perturbative approach, is to set all of these epsilon here to be small, and I will set them to be numerically equal in the following, just for the sake of illustration. So in this perturbative approach in particular, there is no reason anymore to restrict yourself to the second post-Newtonian function of GR that is known for 20 years now. What you can do is replace it by the best available G00 function that we know today, which is known at 5 PN order. So basically, it's the Padé resummation of this Taylor expansion. So 1 minus 2U, U is M over R, so this is Schwarzschild. This is 2 PN, 3 PN, 4 PN. All of this is known analytically. And 5 PN, this is known by comparison with numerical relativity. This is what we call EOBNR. OK. So now we have this. And on top of this, we add our scalar tensor corrections here. So here we are. Let me show you the ISCO location and the associated orbital frequency. This basically corresponds to the peak frequency that you would observe at the end of a chirp, right? So this is GAB M over R, so ISCO location and frequency. When epsilon is zero, you have GR, the values of GR. If I switch on scalar tensor corrections, that is I switch on epsilon, you get these curves here. Forget about these dotted lines. This is what happens when you forget to resum the whole metric. So we have these straight lines here that increase with epsilon with a slope of 0.13. And this tells you, in turn, that you could expect significant relative corrections to GR, so of a few percent, as soon as epsilon, that is alpha squared, the scalar charge squared, is of order 10^-2.
Okay. So in GR, this disco frequency is interesting because it is observable that K is invariant, right? Like if you have this background space time. Or if you have this helical symmetry of the binary, so it's somehow K is invariant.
Yes. Yes.
So for this scalar dependent series, is it also K invariant? Otherwise, it's a it's a gauge dependent.
Yeah, no. So yeah, so what I can say, I did not mention this, but in the canonical transformation that we had, for circular orbits, the canonical transformation is such that the angle is the real angle. So really, the ISCO frequency is gauge independent. So this is really what you can observe. This is an effective location that you cannot observe, and it is gauge dependent, but the ISCO frequency is gauge independent. This is what you observe in your detectors. Okay. Okay, so before I switch to the second part of this seminar, let me do a quick recap. So we have managed to extend the EOB framework to scalar tensor theories, but a priori, any theory that satisfies the constraints, right, could be mapped towards this formalism. Now, why did I insist so much on the scalar charge, and why did I set it to be small? Well, that's because we already know from constraints in the solar system and in binary pulsar experiments that, in fact, alpha has to be very small. It has to be smaller than 10^-6. So if you go back to the observations of the corrections to the ISCO, I said that we needed epsilon, that is alpha squared, of order 10^-2. So it seems unlikely that with this effect, we improve the current constraints.
Also, the branch taking coupling constant omega.
Omega, you said?
Omega, yes. Taking coupling.
Yes.
If you're in the Jordan frame.
Yes, so omega is directly, yes, so it is related to alpha, so I don't remember. I think alpha squared is 1/2 + omega.
Omega is bigger than 50,000.
Yes. It has to be very, yes. So this is perfectly equivalent to saying that this is small. It's just, yes, it depends on the frame you are.
Very close to GR.
Yes. So, but now I see two reasons why scalar tensor theories still deserve attention. The first reason is that, as you know, in these theories, you can have some scalarization effects, where basically a neutron star can grow a non-perturbative scalar charge. So this, for example, you have spontaneous scalarization and dynamical scalarization that even happens near the merger, which is precisely the regime that we observe here. The other reason why I think it's interesting is that this constraint is basically at a redshift zero. This is today. Now the detectors, the gravitational wave detectors, they are designed to observe sources that emitted at a non-negligible redshift. And yet it is known that GR is an attractor of scalar tensor theories. So you could hope that maybe today scalar tensor effects are small, but it is not excluded that at some different redshift, they might have been bigger. So I think that gravitational wave experiments are not only the occasion to test scalar tensor theories, but also the occasion to constrain at least part of their history, let's say.
Yeah. So like another way to evade that constraint is to add like a mass term to the scalar potential, right? So
yes.
That shuts it off at these distances we have.
Yes.
Stars, but then it would be effective on
yes.
the scale.
But when you
so
add, yes.
Have you thought about doing that?
Yeah, of course, but when you add, so when you have massive fields, the field equations become much more involved and much more complicated. So then you have to ask if, is it worth doing it or not? And the thing is, if you add a mass, you need it to be not too small and not too large. It has to define a scale, which is basically the size of your binary system if you want to see the effects of the mass. So, okay, yeah, you could do it. I did not do it, but I don't know if anybody.
So why is it that it makes it so much harder?
Sorry?
So why is it that it makes it so much harder? Just that.
Well, for example, your fields, they do not behave as 1 over r anymore. It's 1 over r times the power of, so a non, how do you say? A non-integer, yes, and you also have an exponential cutoff, but not only that, so it becomes much more involved. So this is why. Another thing that you can do, so let me just go back to black holes. So as we said, we know that in scalar tensor theories, black holes have no hair. And I think a way to understand this, just looking at the Lagrangian, the action, sorry, is to see that, in fact, the vacuum action is shift symmetric. The scalar field only appears through its derivatives. So it is defined up to a constant. So black holes that are solutions of the vacuum action, that means they are not sensitive to the asymptotic, the background value of the scalar field. And this is the reason, as you will see, the reason why they have no hair. So a way to give hair to your black hole is or to give a mass term so that you break the shift symmetry, or to induce scalar hair by means of other degrees of freedom, for example, a vector gauge field. So what I will turn to in the second part of this seminar is the case of Einstein-Maxwell dilation theories. Okay, so in the Einstein frame, again, it's just like scalar tensor theories, but now you add a vector field, which is not necessarily really Maxwell's field. It's just a new degree of freedom of gravity that you can call gravifoton, if you wish. Now, what is interesting is this term, specific term. So it's a dilatonic coupling to the scalar field. So there is a non-minimal coupling between the vector field and the scalar field that is parameterized by this new fundamental constant A. So when A is zero, this is just Einstein-Maxwell minimally coupled to a scalar field, so it is shift symmetric. If I switch on A, I explicitly break the shift symmetry. If F is non-trivial, this term breaks the shift symmetry. Also, for matter, we will simply suppose that it is again minimally coupled to the Jordan metric and to the vector field. Okay, so now, since again this theory is manifestly Lorentz invariant, we know that at least at first post-Keplerian order, we can include it to the EOB framework. And in particular, we can include hairy black holes predicted in these theories into EOB. So this is the main goal of this part now.
Sorry, now what you just said is much more general than what you said before. So now this is a general statement that every time you're dealing with a theory that is Lorentz invariant, you know you can embed it in.
I know I can at first post-Keplerian order. Okay. Because at first post-Keplerian order, there was only one constraint, remember, and I said these two coefficients, they are zero if the kinetic term comes from square root of 1 minus v squared. This will be the case here, because we know we can do it at 1 pk. Okay.
When you investigate the vacuum solution, the vector field,
yes,
it turns out I have modified gravity theory, which I published. Mm-hmm. And the charge of the vector field is proportional to mass. It's not electric charge.
Yes, the gravity photonic charge.
A gravity spin of one gravity. So
yes.
In this black hole solutions you get now, the coverage invariants are not singular.
Yes.
And have an event horizon.
Yes.
And it looks like slideshow, but it isn't slideshow.
Yes. In fact, I will discuss this. I will show you that there is a transition. These black holes, they can transition between a Schwarzschild-like regime and another regime. But I don't want to spoil too much what I'm going to say at the end. So. But yes.
Yeah,
I will come back to this.
It's important to point out that the charge, black holes are not. Mm-hmm. They're electrically neutral, obviously. If you have a charge, you have positive and negative charge.
Yeah, you expect the charge to be vanishingly small, yes. Not necessarily zero, but vanishingly small.
Astrophysical bodies are neutral.
Yes. Because of screening, yes, yeah.
In the case of the Stanton model coupling constants, they're very short-range forces, so they can have no effect on the matter.
Well, I will show you that this is not so. Well, in fact, this is one of the things I would like to show. Even if the electric charge is vanishingly small, you can have large effects, large deviations from GR. This is what I'm going to show.
Sorry, can I ask a question? So you mentioned this both GR and scalar tensor can be mapped to EOB and
yes.
Second post Caperian order.
Seven? No, two.
Two PK or one
yes,
order.
Yes.
And so what about three PK? Is GR still
no, even
GR,
even GR at 3 pk, you cannot map it simply to a geodesic motion. You need to modify your effective Hamiltonian. This was just an aspect of EOB, so at that time, yes, they needed to add, so Damour et al., they needed to add some Finsler-type terms, they say, into their effective Hamiltonian, yes. So in fact, even at 3 pn, GR cannot be mapped towards a simple geodesic motion. That's true. So it becomes a bit more complicated. It's true. Okay, so what we want to do is put hairy black holes in EOB. But before that, of course, we have to go back to square one, which is how do you compute the two-body Lagrangian in this theory? But so now you have another difficulty, which is how do I generalize Erdle's approach to point particles. What should I write in EMD theories? Well, my claim, so it's in a recent work that I've published, is that the most generic action that you can write, point particle action that describes any compact body, is very simple. It is nothing but an Erdle type term, okay, with M of phi, plus the standard electromagnetic term. And the reason is the following. A priori, your point particle action, it can depend on all the fields, so G mu nu, A mu, and phi. But at the same time, it has to preserve the gauge symmetries of your fundamental theory. So you realize that it has to be covariant and U1 gauge symmetric. Now, the only way to be U1 gauge symmetric is that your action is linear in the vector. Because as everybody knows, once you have this linear coupling, well, you just inject A mu plus D mu chi, you integrate by parts, and you realize that this action is gauge invariant, provided that you have the standard U1 current that is conserved. And so that means also that this small q will play the role of your conserved U1 charge. So contrarily to M that can depend on phi, q cannot be a function of phi. It has to be an absolute constant. It is your conserved charge. Okay, now you could also argue that we could add terms that contain derivatives of the fields. For example, we could add f mu nu, or d mu phi squared, or whatever. All these terms, they contain derivatives of the fields, and they amount for what we call finite size effects that I will neglect in this talk. So basically, if you add space gradients, this is the tidal forces that you can add. And if you put time derivatives of the fields, this would amount for out of equilibrium effects. So really, the way you have to understand this is that we are describing a generic body that we will treat adiabatically. That is, we will suppose it to be all the time in equilibrium. So M of phi means that it depends on phi, the local value, so homogeneous value of the scalar field that is imposed by the faraway companion, and which is supposed to vary slowly such that the body here readjusts adiabatically. Okay, so then in a few minutes, I will show you how to compute explicitly M and Q for hairy black holes. For the moment, let's just keep again a bit generic and compute the two-body Lagrangian of EMD for any binary system. So now we have in hands all of what we need. Well, it's just the vacuum action plus 2-point particles. So again, you can write your field equations that are sourced by two points. And so I will go a bit quicker. Now, if you compute the two-body Lagrangian at first post-Caperian order, well, again, you expand the field equations and you solve them iteratively around a background that you can gauge away to Minkowski, a vector background that you can gauge away to zero, and a scalar background that, again, you cannot set to zero because the theory is not shift symmetric. So it's the phi zero that will be imposed by cosmology. It's the environment of the binary system. You again expand your M of phi functions around this phi zero. So the computation is just a bit more complicated than for scalar tensor theories because you also have the two charges and the fundamental parameter A. Once you have done this, here is the two-body Lagrangian that you get. At Keplerian order, you recognize again the Newton-like Lagrangian, where GAB, just as in scalar tensor theories, is 1 plus alpha squared. But now you have another term, a repulsive term, where E is the ratio Q over M times a diatonic factor, let's say. So this is what we will call the vector coupling. Okay, so again, you see the linear addition of the three interactions now. What is interesting is that, in fact, even at 1 pK order, this Lagrangian is exactly the same as in scalar tensor theories. It has exactly the same structure. You have, again, GAB, gamma AB, and the betas here. So it's exactly the same. In fact, it's just the same slide as the one in the beginning. The only difference is that now GAB, gamma, and beta are a bit more complicated. If I switch off the electric charge, of course, the E's are zero, and I'll recover what we had in scalar tensor theories. So everything, all the effects of the vector field are completely encoded here. So what that means is that all what I've said about EOB in scalar tensor theories is already true. Also in the EMD case, all the results that I've showed that depended on these betas and gamma, the only thing you have to do is replace them by their expression in EMD theories. That's all you do. So this is valid again in EMD theories too. Okay. So let me recap what we've done. We have started from this new skeleton action. So skeleton means when you reduce to a point particles, because basically the word tubes, you reduce them to word lines. So this is why it looks like a skeleton. So you call it skeletonization. So this, the two-body Lagrangian that we found, it depended on the masses, the scalar charge, and its derivative, and the vector coupling. Now, as I said, the reason why we were interested in EMD is because we have hairy black holes. So what I propose to do now in the last part of this talk is to compute explicitly M of phi and Q for hairy black holes. In particular, we will concentrate on a specific example that was found by Gibbons and Maeda in 88. So this is a black hole with vector hair and scalar hair, scalar-induced hairs. So this black hole depends on three integration constants. R plus, which is the location of the horizon, R minus, which is the singularity, and phi infinity, which is the background of your black hole. So for example here, BQ, which is the electric charge, it's not an independent integration constant. In fact, it can be expressed in terms of R plus, R minus, and phi infinity. Okay, so just a few comments about this black hole. Again, you recover the fact that the electric charge is crucial for your black hole to have scalar hair. Remember, if F mu nu is trivial, the shift symmetry is recovered, so the scalar hair have to switch off. This is the case, because when Q is zero, that is when R minus is zero, the scalar hair are switched off here. And also, this metric reduces to Schwarzschild. So when Q is zero, the vector and scalar hair switch off and you are back to GR. You have a Schwarzschild black hole. Another interesting limit is the decoupling limit, when you decouple the vector from the scalar field. So it's when A equals zero, and in that case, again, the scalar field is switched off. And the black hole that you find is exactly the Reissner-Nordström black hole. Okay, so the
Jordan frame, G is constant.
In the Jordan frame, G, what G?
The big G.
The
frame and the Einstein frame.
Yes.
The Einstein frame,
yes.
Is constant.
Yes.
So Einstein frame.
Yes, so I work only in the Einstein frame because it's easier to see GRs.
Jordan frame.
Yeah.
So if you map it into
in a Jordan frame, you interpret G as being depending on where you are in space time.
It's
another way to say
it. Inside the integram reaction. Yeah. So you still have to think about mapping into Jordan frame.
So
that gets difficult.
Yeah, so I don't know what this looks like in the Jordan. In fact, I don't like so much the Jordan frame because, okay, matter becomes minimally coupled to the metric, but it's much more complicated to see the GR limit. For example, the fact that black holes have no hair and all that, it's much easier to do it in the Einstein frame because you recover the Schwarzschild metric. It's easier.
Particles move along geodesics.
Yes.
In the Jordan frame.
Yes, exactly.
They do not move along geodesics. In the Einstein
frame. In the Einstein frame, it's not geodesic.
It makes life more difficult.
Yes, but your field equations are simpler, and the problem is well posed, and you have your Cauchy conditions and all that. Yeah, so it's a matter of taste, but my preference is for the Einstein frame. Okay, so. As I said, what I want to show now is how do you compute explicitly M of phi and Q for a black hole? Well, in fact, it is pretty simple. The only thing you have to do is to expand. You don't need the complete fields. You just expand them at infinity. And as I will show to you, these 1 over r terms, so the first term of the expansion, it depends on the three integration constants, r plus or minus and phi infinity. And as you will see, this encodes all the necessary information that you need to compute exactly M of phi and Q. That is to address the dynamics of a black hole. So you have this 1 over r behavior of the fields. Then, step 2, you go back to your effective particle that is supposed to take on the role of the real black hole. And you write again, you go to the near world line region of this particle. So let's say it's particle A that is supposed to be the black hole. So you write the field equations that are sourced by particle A only, because since we neglect finite size effects, the only impact of the faraway companion is to impose a scalar background, so phi infinity, what we call phi infinity. And then you solve again at the lowest order the field equations. So you solve them around Minkowski, a zero vector background, and the phi infinity, which is imposed by the faraway companion. Then you find this expression, again, the 1 over r terms that depend on m evaluated at phi infinity, its derivative, and your electric charge q. Okay, so what do you do now? Well, it is obvious. You say that a necessary condition is that the fields generated here by this effective point, they have to match the fields generated by the real black hole. That's all you have to do. When you write it, you obtain 3 matching conditions. So let's imagine that we are skeletonizing, so reducing to a point particle, a neutron star. What you would say here is, oh, well, I have computed M of phi. What remains to do is to compute explicitly R plus and R minus as a function of what's inside the star. So for example, it will depend on the bionic number, on the equation of state. All of this is a bit complicated. Now my point is that for black holes, life is much easier. Because, in fact, you don't need to know what's inside your black hole. The only thing you have to remember is that big Q, the electric charge, was not an independent integration constant. It was written as a function of r plus, r minus, and phi infinity. So let us replace big Q, r plus, and r minus in terms of the skeleton counterpart here using the matching conditions. When you do it, you find a first-order differential equation that should be satisfied by your M of phi function. So here we are. We have all we need to determine the exact not perturbative, the exact M of phi function for an EMD black hole. So how do you do? Well, so we just wanted to describe the motion of EMD black hole, neglecting finite-sized effects. And what we understand now is that for a black hole, its motion will be completely determined by 2 parameters only. The first one is the conserved electric charge, Q, that also enters the differential equation. And the second parameter that will appear is a unique integration constant, because this is just a first order differential equation. So this integration constant, I will call it mu. So let's do it explicitly. First, for the sake of simplicity, I'll do it for A equals 1. When A equals 1, this term drops. So here, it is very simple to integrate by sides. You just recognize the derivative of m squared over 2. So what you get is this square root. So here is what I think is for the first time, the sensitivity of a hairy black hole. It depends on two parameters, as I said. The first parameter is Q, the electric charge, where again, as you can see, is fundamental for your black hole to have scalar hair. If the electric charge is zero, M of phi reduces to a constant, and so both the vector and scalar hair are switched off. The second parameter, which is the integration constant of this differential equation, you can also give it a physical meaning. The way you do it is you invert it, and using back the matching conditions, you express mu in terms of r plus and r minus. And when you do it, you realize that mu squared is nothing but the area of the horizon of your black hole. So I think I should do a short break about what we've done. I think this is an interesting part aspect of the point particle approach, because in fact, there is more physics that inside this procedure that, than what we wanted to do at first. We just wanted to describe the motion of these black holes, but in fact, in passing, it tells us that when I have a black hole here, its companion imposes a background scalar field. When the companion moves slowly, the scalar field phi infinity varies, and this, in turn, imposes this black hole to readjust its equilibrium configuration. The skeletonization tells us that the way it readjusts its equilibrium configuration, that is r plus and r minus, is in keeping its electric charge and area. You see, it's not the ADM mass that is conserved, it's the area. So charge and area. Okay. So now, well, how do you deal with the motion of these EMD black holes? Well, we have all we need. We already have the two-body Lagrangian. So you just have to compute explicitly the scalar charge, which is just the derivative of the log of m, beta, and the vector coupling. So let me show you what you get. The result is particularly striking. If you inject square root if in the derivative of log of m, you find that alpha, the scalar charge, is nothing but a symptom. As a function of the cosmological background of the binary, it's nothing but a simple Fermi-Dirac distribution, which highlights the crucial influence of phi zero on the dynamics of your black hole. You see, when so this is phi zero, this is alpha. When phi zero increases through a critical value that is determined by your specific black hole, so by the ratio mu over q, the black hole transitions between two regimes. On the left side, when phi zero is too small, you find that alpha is zero, and alpha is very flat, so all of the successive derivatives are zero. So the scalar hair are completely off. But you find also that E, the electric charge, the electric coupling is zero too, zero also. So in that region, if the cosmological environment is too small, your black hole is completely indistinguishable from a Schwarzschild black hole, right? Now on the right side, when phi zero is large enough, your black hole has scalarized, if you wish. Alpha is one, which is quite huge. Alpha is one, and the vector coupling squared tends to two. So what we have is a black hole that is largely coupled to the vector and scalar field. So in turn, this will, well, so this is what measures the deviations from GR, right? So all of these terms, they will become of order one. You can expect large deviations from GR, okay? Okay, note also that, so these are three black holes, right? So I have three ratios, mu over q, so area over charge. Note that the regimes are universal. The only influence, the body dependence, is just in the location of the transition, right? It just enters through the log of m over q. So you see, even when q is vanishingly small, it goes like the log of 1 over q. So now I will just generalize. OK, it's nearly the end. I will generalize this result to generic theories, so for whatever value of the parameter a. In that case, this differential equation, you can solve it also. There is an exact solution, but it is a bit heavy, so I did not copy it. It's not very enlightening to show it. What I show is just, so I just plotted alpha again. So this is the cosmological environment phi zero. This is alpha. And the third dimension is the value of the parameter A. When A is zero, alpha is zero, and you are back to a Reissner-Nordström black hole. When you switch on A, when A is one, it's the Fermi Dirac distribution. And when you increase again A, you see that the same patterns appear, but the transition becomes steeper and steeper. For example, here alpha transitions, in fact, from zero to A, where A is the parameter of the theory. So again, we see the same features as before. If phi zero is too small, you can increase A, the coupling, as much as you want. Your black hole is completely indistinguishable from a Schwarzschild black hole, because alpha, but also E, are zero. On the right side, when phi zero is large enough, your black hole has scalarized. Alpha tends to A, and E squared tends to 1 plus A squared. So this highlights, again, the crucial influence of the cosmological environment, phi zero, on the dynamics of a black hole. Okay, so I will just finish on the most striking example, I think, because here we just looked at the behavior of a black hole in the presence of an arbitrary companion. Let's imagine that now we have two EMD black holes. For example, let's imagine that we have this blue black hole and this yellow one. Let's also assume that phi zero, the cosmological background, is large enough so that the two black holes have scalarized. Okay? And thirdly, let us assume that the two electric charges have the same sign, so that the vector interaction will be repulsive. In that case, you compute your two-body Lagrangian. So again, for example, GAB, it was 1 plus alpha squared minus E squared. So that gives you 1 plus A squared minus 1 plus A squared, which is 0. So when your two black holes have scalarized, lots of interaction terms are just dropped. And in fact, the only interaction term that remains is the one that is proportional to the relative velocity squared. So what do we have here? We see explicitly that when the two black holes have scalarized, the metric scalar and repulsive vector interaction, they perfectly compensate to allow for even configuration at rest. If you have black hole with no initial kick, the initial relative velocity is zero, so this term falls, and you just have two black holes that are just facing each other. They don't move anymore. Okay, another interesting case is when A squared is 3. This is the dimensional reduction of Kaluza-Klein. Your two black holes behave as two free particles. They just don't see each other. Okay, so all this is reminiscent of what you might know, which is the Mayumdar-Papapetrou spacetime. It's when you have two Reissner-Nordström black holes that are extremal. That is when the AGM mass is equal to the electric charge. In that case, you have explicit solutions of two black holes, spacetime solutions at rest. In fact, if you look at E, the vector coupling, it is nothing that electric charge over AGM mass squared, but with corrections coming from EMD theories. So now we understand what is the scalarization of black holes in EMD. In fact, black holes that scalarize in EMD theories, they just transition towards a quasi-extremal regime. You see, they just set themselves towards an extremal regime that allows for configurations at rest. But what is particularly interesting is that in the Reissner-Nordström case, the electric charge and the AGM mass are constant. They are conserved constant. So you need to fine-tune your black hole so that it becomes extremal. What's interesting here is that whatever the black hole you start with, you give it a charge and an area, it will fine-tune itself towards this quasi-extremal state. So I think it's a bit more interesting than the pure Reissner-Nordström case. Okay, I have minus 4 minutes left, right? So I don't know if I have time to conclude. Just say a few words. Okay. Okay, so very shortly, I would like to say that I hope I illustrated the fact that EOB might be a very interesting framework to put within a common formalism any a large class of theories. So to me, it's a bit like the equivalent of the PPN framework that was broadly used to make tests in the solar systems. Here, it's a bit the same, but for binary coalescence. So in particular, you could imagine, so we already put EMD and scalar tensor into this parameterized metric, but you could imagine that these epsilons become theory agnostic coefficients. So this would be the most generic deviations that you could have for to GR. Okay, in the second part, I also showed you how to generalize Hurdle's approach to hairy black holes. And in doing so, we showed that EMD black holes are quite interesting because they can transition to from a Schwarzschild behavior to an extremal behavior. And this, I hope, convinces you now that it is crucial that we observe the broadest possible range of redshifts, because at each redshift, the cosmological environment phi zero could have different values. And so you could expect redshifts where the black holes, they behave exactly as in GR. You don't see any deviations. And other redshifts where your black holes become extremal. OK, so a word about what I'm doing now. I need to add the radiation reaction force. So it is known at second, the 2.5 Poiskeperian order in scalar tensor theories. What is unknown is the radiation reaction force in EMD theories, though. So this is what I'm doing now. OK, thanks.
Do you know if the range in redshifts to which LIGO detectors are sensible is enough to?
LIGO, I think it's not so far, right? The redshifts.
Sorry.
It's so, yes, what is more, I don't know the numbers, but I guess if maybe two or three.
And that's enough to
Even less?
A good range in alpha in this cosmological environment.
Well, it depends completely then on your cosmological model. So the way, so EMD theories at cosmological scales, you can fairly suppose that they will behave as scalar tensor theories because of the screening of the vector field. And now in scalar tensor theories, this phi zero is driven by an effective potential that depends on your Jordan metric, on the A of phi function. So it depends completely on the model you look at. But you, for example, yeah, if you take Brown's Dickey, so the potential that drives phi zero goes like the log of A of phi. So Brown's Dickey A is exponential of alpha times phi. So you can have a slope that lets phi decrease or increase. But I don't know.
LIGO is just one example, right? So eventually, Cosby Explorer will be redshift 20. LISA will be redshift as well. So.
With LISA, I think the hope is to go up to redshift 10 or 15, maybe. Yeah. So then you can go pretty far, yes. So you could hope, that phi zero. But you see, you don't need phi zero to vary so much because the transition is very steep. In fact, for example, in the theory A equals 1, you see that the size of the transition is, you see, of the order unity. You need phi to transition, for example, from 0 to 3, let's say. So you don't need a huge shift.
In nature, for a body, like the ratio of the electromagnetic force to the gravitational force is 10 to the power of 40.
Uh-huh.
So even if a black hole has a tiny electric charge,
yes.
It's a simple calculation.
Yeah, but as I said,
electric charge to the
this vector field is not necessarily really the Maxwell field. It can be a graviphoton. It's just a new degree of freedom.
What is the charge?
Sorry? The charge is just the U1 charge associated to this gauge field. I mean, it's just a new gauge field that does not belong to the standard model. This is what everybody does all the time, adding some new.
The charge is proportional to mass.
Why would it be proportional?
Square root of g mu times n is dimensions of electric charge. So the charge proportions are less. Okay.
I don't see why.
That makes it a gravity theory.
Okay.
I'll talk to you.
Yeah, I would be interested in that because I don't see why the charge should be. To me, it's independent from. I mean, you have your U1 charge and you have your AGM mass or whatever. I don't see they are two independent. But okay.
So I have a question. Yes. So maybe you said this, but I mean, so I see you can get scalarization by just changing the field at infinity.
Yes.
Can you get spontaneous scalarization with like two?
Yes. Yeah, well, so no, I'm saying yes. I don't know, but I'm feeling like yes.
So,
because so what I've commented here is only a perturbative approach. So what we did is, for example, expand m of phi around phi 0. So if you are here, you expand around here. So this is why you see no new effect in a perturbative approach. But now, when the black holes get closer and closer, of course, phi could change a lot. So in fact, you could imagine that you have a black hole, and now you plot it as a function of phi infinity, because this is the real environment of your black hole. The non-perturbative environment is phi infinity. So you would have exactly the same alpha function. So if the black holes are far away, you could imagine a Schwarzschild black hole. And when they get closer and closer, you could imagine that phi increases. And so your black hole could do this jump. So okay, maybe I wouldn't call it a dynamical scalarization because it has nothing to do with phase transition. But yes, you can see huge deviations that appear only in the strong field, in principle. I would say so.
So the question is, you argue what happened with this influence of the scalar field as it changes for the charge. Do you know what would be the effect with the spin? I mean, can it renormalize the spin, and if so, by how much?
Yes, so spins, I don't really know. What I can say is that, okay, there is maybe something that I can say. So this m of phi function, so in fact, this m is the AGM mass, as I said, which is not conserved in scalar tensor theories because you have phi. So let's forget about q. What we call irreducible mass is exactly this. You have AGM mass equals square root of irreducible mass squared plus j squared, typically. So in fact, mu, it is the square root of the area. This is what you call irreducible mass in the case of spinning black holes. So I would expect that in this square root, you have also a plus j squared term that appears. But you can expect it to be a constant. So what would happen more, I can't say. At least in the point particle action, you would need to add also some finite size terms, right? So you have to endow your point with a spin. You mean you have to add something in this formalism. But I don't expect the scalar field to have any impact on the spin. I guess it's independent. I'm not sure.
Let's think through this again.